I'm Jen White. This is 1A.
Brent Cooper. Mark Orlick.
In 1992, hundreds gathered on the National Mall to view the AIDS quilt. It was enormous, a memorial made up of panels, each commemorating a life lost to HIV/AIDS.
Eric Erickson. Ron Halley. Tom DiGeronimo.
But a few blocks away, demonstrators marched to the front of the White House for a very different type of action.
Bring the dead to your door! We won't take it anymore!
Roughly 300 anti-AIDS activists broke through a police line and threw the ashes of their dead loved ones onto the White House lawn. David Robinson was one of them.
I think the quilt itself does good stuff and is moving. Still, it's like making something beautiful out of the epidemic. And I felt like doing something like this is a way of showing there's nothing beautiful about it. You know, this is what I'm left with. I've got a box full of ashes and bone chips. You know, there's no beauty in that. And I felt like a statement like this, throwing these on the White House lawn, is like saying this is what George Bush has done. You know, this is what him and Ronald Reagan before him have done.
Two different acts of protest, both with the same goal. But what makes an action successful? And can the tactics and strategies used back then still bring about change now? Tracy Hunt is a reporter with WNYC's Radio Lab. She's also a producer on the upcoming podcast, The Experiment, from WNYC and The Atlantic. She's producing a special Radio Lab episode on the anti-AIDS movement. It's called The Ashes on the Lawn, and it'll be released later this week. Tracy, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. Hi.
Also with us is David Robinson. He's currently a high school teacher in Oakland, California, and he's a former member of ACT UP, the AIDS Coalition to Unleash Power. You just heard a bit of him speaking back in 1992. David, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. I'm really pleased to be here.
Tracy, why did you start researching the subject?
Yeah, it's I kind of got into it in a really kind of roundabout way, but I had just been, you know, me and a bunch of other people at Radiolab, we had just been really interested in different ways of, you know, remembering people, and then also this question of, like, what does a dead body mean? Are we too separated from dead bodies? What's the right way to say goodbye to someone? And so, like, at first I was just sort of interested in different ways that people have done funerals and memorials. And then a friend at WNIC told me about the Ashes Action, and I was just shocked because I'd never heard about it. And there was just something so haunting and powerful about the thought of there being, you know, ashes on the South Lawn of the White House. And, you know, and I was just like, I just wanted to know more about it. And, you know, how sometimes stories get put to the side when you're a journalist because you have to do other things. But back in February and March, when it was looking like we were all going into quarantine and we were in the middle of, you know, another public health emergency, I thought about it again, and that's when I started reaching out to people like David, because I really just wanted to know, you know, my question changed a lot. Like, at, you know, it was first, it was like, how do you, you know, deal with dead bodies? How do you memorialize people? And then it became a question of, what do you do when you're in the middle of a pandemic and the government doesn't seem to be doing the right thing? And then the protest over the summer happened, the George Floyd protest, and then it was like, wow, this like moment has so many different lessons for us, and I was also just searching about what I can do in this moment as a journalist, as a citizen, and it just kept, yeah, it was just really, really interesting to me.
Well, David, you were basically the impetus for the Ashes Action Tracy is talking about. Talk us through what led to that idea.
Well, my partner, Warren, whom I was living with in San Francisco, was had AIDS and was getting sicker. And he had gotten to a point where he really couldn't get out of the house very much. And prior to that point, we had done a lot of AIDS activism together. And I had done a lot in New York City. But as he got sicker, and, you know, he was only 33 when he died, he got angrier, and he really wanted to still be able to make a difference. And I know at one point we just talked about, I think, something that a number of AIDS activists at the time were probably separately talking about, which was, well, when I die, can I still make an impact? My recollection is that we actually talked about whether bringing his body, you know, to the White House would be possible, but he ended up getting dementia. And so those conversations ended the last couple months of his life. But after he died, I was thinking about, well, what can I do? I was grieving very heavily, but I wanted to make an impact. And I guess I had a conversation with comrades from ACT UP New York and said I wanted to do something with his ashes. I think I thought, well, maybe I'll send them to the White House, but that would be too private. No one would know. And, you know, friends and comrades at ACT UP New York said, oh, we can make this happen. Let's actually make this a demonstration. And yeah, they organized it very, very quickly.
Yeah, and the footage of that is very powerful. Tracy, I want to play a piece of your upcoming episode of Radiolab that deals with the ashes demonstration. And this is part of an interview with Alexis Danzig, who lost her father to AIDS. And then, David, we hear you right at the end of the clip.
I was in a line of people who were carrying their beloved person's ashes in a variety of different kinds of vessels. Some had ashes in a baggie.
What was your ashes in?
I had created a box.
Mm-hmm.
It was painted black with gold line drawings on it.
And then for like the last section of the march, as we were getting closer to the White House, I just remember almost a grim feeling.
David, you said almost a grim feeling. Can you take us to that moment and what was going on for you?
Yeah. By the way, just hearing Alexis, you know, I get choked up. I remember talking with her right before we started marching. You know, this was coming at a point in the movement where we had been fighting as an AIDS activist movement, you know, well, since the mid-80s, but ACT UP had started in 87. And despite spreading across the country and eventually around the world and seemingly having a really huge impact on public consciousness, there were still no effective treatments for AIDS. And people were still just dying. And we still had a government that really didn't care. And the grimness was finally having gotten to a point where it felt to me like we had exhausted symbolic means of protest, doing die-ins, chalking our bodies on the, you know, outlines on the street, coming up with ever more, I don't know, creative ways to try to get the media's attention. And this just, it felt like the reality of our grief in as focused a way as I could experience it and communicate it. And I didn't see, I don't know, at that moment when I said grim, it just felt like we were at the end of, to me, the end of what we could do.
You said that many protests are symbolic. There's a lot of symbolism. But I think about the symbolism of you giving these ashes to this action. Mm-hmm. And I wonder about how difficult that decision was for you.
There was, you know, I had those kind of qualms that, to me, I think of as irrational, that, you know, Warren was gone, you know, nothing was bringing him back. And this box that I had been given by the funeral home with a baggie in it that contained ashes and bone chips, that wasn't him. And no matter what I did to dress it up with an urn or anything else, it wasn't going to be him. So although I had those sort of feelings of not wanting to lose more of him, I got over that pretty quickly. And what I held on to was this was a way for me to help him continue to impact the world. That felt meaningful to me. Still does.
Tracy, 2020 is a year that's been characterized in large part by pandemic and protests. What parallels do you see between the late 80s, early 90s, and where we are now?
Yeah, I see a lot of parallels. I also see a lot of differences, and the differences are just as important, I think. In the late 80s, we had a disease that was seemingly only affecting a certain group of people, and at a time, a group of people it was a very mainstream opinion to despise this group of people, gay men, intravenous drug users, people from other countries. One person I talked to said that, this seemed like this was a disease for the homos, Haitians, and hemophiliacs, this was a time when it was just like, well, that's only affecting them. And you do see that with this pandemic again, even though, it's affecting everyone, but it is seemingly like you see people are just like, well, it only affects old people, or it only affects people who have pre-existing conditions, or it only affects, Black people, or they're the ones that are mostly dying. I don't have to worry about it. And so, like, that's kind of one parallel I see, disturbingly. And then with the protest, one thing that I was kind of struck by was that at the time, a lot of people who call themselves allies of ACT UP were criticized ACT UP a lot because of some of the actions they did, like storming the church when they got into St. Patrick's Cathedral and they had die-ins and there was yelling. There was also, people would look at those kinds of protests and be like, well, has ACT UP gone too far? And then obviously this summer, where a lot of the protest actions that we were seeing in the streets did look scary as far as like there was property damage, there was fire, but all that can also just be seen as like a reaction to it was an acting out of a profound sense of grief and rage. And so and then of course all the conversation about, well, is this hurting the Black Lives Matter movement? You can't protest like that. And so there always seems to be this like kind of policing of protesting that I thought was really interesting, and this idea that there's like the right way to protest and there's a wrong way to protest.
Yeah.
And the fact that conversation was happening again was really interesting to me.
Well, a lot of ACT UP's demonstrations, as you say, were designed to be not nice. David, ACT UP heckled people, burned Dr. Anthony Fauci in effigy.
Yes.
And then I compare that to what we heard you saying earlier about the beauty of the AIDS quilt. And how were you navigating that space at the time of realizing there is a crisis and there is an inadequate response? And we've got to pull attention to it, but also that kind of policing of behavior that Tracy just described.
Well, I felt and still do that in some ways there's no inherent right or wrong about a particular tactic, except, let's say, obviously committing violence against human beings or animals for that matter. But it's how you implement them. So take the names quilt. Which I thought was beautiful and powerful. I made an angry panel, but I made a panel for memorializing Warren. It's in the quilt. But the people who were organizing the reading of names, which you used at the top of the story, made a decision to allow to invite President George Bush Sr. to read names. And I remember being furious about that and thinking politically that was actually undermining the impact of the quilt, because Bush and Reagan were directly responsible for so many people having died from AIDS. And they, like, if Bush had read names, he would be using the quilt to make himself look more compassionate without changing any of his policies. So my objection ultimately is sometimes about, are you using your tactic strategically? And that's really how I felt about, you know, burning Anthony Fauci in effigy, which I'm sure he remembers fondly, or even the few people who at our Stop the Church demonstration at St. Patrick's Cathedral that Tracy alluded to. Most of the demonstration was outside, but those who, you know, interrupted inside made a very calculated decision.
We're talking about AIDS, ACT UP, and protesting for change with Radiolab's Tracy Hunt and former ACT UP activist David Robinson. Randa writes on Facebook, in the 80s, AIDS was being swept under the rug by the president, Congress, and medical community because it was considered to be a gay disease. I heard people actually say that gay people deserve to contract this terrible disease. It wasn't until Ryan White, a young boy, and other straight persons started dying of the disease that it was taken seriously. Civil disobedience and other protests were necessary to get the foot-dragging establishment to wake up. Coming up, 30 years before he dealt with COVID-19, Dr. Anthony, as we said, was burned in effigy by anti-AIDS activists. We'll hear more from our guests and from you in a moment. I'm Jen White. This is 1A.
This message comes from AT&T, committed to keeping students and teachers connected. AT&T has connected over 200 million students with tools and technology for distance learning. More at att.com/remote learning.
Do you talk about the news with your friends, your family, or maybe perfect strangers? You can get all the facts you need to be up to speed on this busy news cycle on the 1A News Roundup. Find the podcast in your feed every Friday.
Abigail Disney says if she ran the family company, she'd deal with the current economic crisis very differently.
A CEO should be like a ship's captain. You know, if other people are drowning, you're the last one off the ship.
Ideas about the history and future of finding financial stability. That's on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
This is 1A. Now let's get back to our conversation about protesting for change with Radiolab's Tracy Hunt and former ACT UP activist David Robinson. Now, Tracy, this is a big question, but it gets right to the heart of what we've been talking about. In your reporting, what did you find about what makes a protest effective?
That is a really big question. And I think the answer I kind of came to is a little unsatisfying, but it's I think the answer is everything. we were talking about the quilt just before we went to break, and one thing that I discovered about the quilt was when I saw that these two things were happening at the same time, I was very like struck by once again their differences. One seemed very somber and quiet and very beautiful, and there were these quilt panels, and the other. And the other demonstration was actual ashes and bone chips being dumped on a lawn, and I felt like, wow, that the ashes action was just so powerful and in your face, and this just pure expression of grief and rage. And then when I interviewed Mike Smith, who was one of the co-founders of the Names Project, he mentioned that. You know, our thing was angry too. We were really angry. You know, we wanted to just like get white pieces of vinyl and like spray paint people's names on it. And, you know, those panels, it's we'd see pictures of them online nowadays, but what we don't kind of, what doesn't translate maybe was that each panel was the size of a grave. It was 6 feet by 3 feet. And each panel, you know, represented a person who died of AIDS. And what you find out is that these quilts were incredibly heavy and almost absurdly so, because it became this like kind of almost absurd public art project of how do you even represent all the people who died of AIDS? We have to cover half of the half of DC to do that at this point, or, you know. And so, and another point he told me was that what happened is that it actually politicized some people. There were people who were, you know, not from the kind of gay men's, you know, corridors of New York and San Francisco and Boys Town and Chicago. You know, there were people, there were women who had lost their sons to AIDS and didn't really feel like they can talk about it in their communities and in their churches. And they were activated by this project. You know, they started sending quilts in, and then they started getting political, and they started calling their congresspeople and demanding more funding. And in that way, the quilt was this way of was like this Trojan horse that, you know, brought in activism and brought in political action to a group of people who maybe never tried that before. Mm-hmm. And so it was really interesting, because what I kind of came down to is that it's not so much like which is better, Ashes or the quilt. It's how they work together. And I'm really sorry about the siren outside my window.
It's okay. Well, we're hearing from some of you. Kelly tweets, I was a kid in the 80s and 90s, but volunteered with AIDS Walk Atlanta during my 4 years of high school. My dad was an oncologist who treated people with it. We both hoped to bring compassion and understanding to people with AIDS. And Webb emails, a friend of mine who worked for Greenpeace helped train ACT UP activists and worked with them on some nonviolent civil disobedience actions. He once told me that they put a giant inflatable condom over Senator Jesse Helms's D.C. residence. They were fierce activists who took bold action because their lives were at stake. And we should say Senator Helms at the time pushed back against any funding for research or treatment or prevention, federal spending, that is. You know, David, talk about some, you know, you talked a lot about using these actions strategically, but what types of planning went into these actions?
Definitely. Just let me say one thing about what Tracy said. What I hear in what she's saying is partly that no one group or no one action is going to do it, and that it's about a movement. And even between the two, if ACT UP had decided to go and protest against the names quilt, that would have been, to me, disastrous, right? Even though I was furious, you know, about how they were at that moment, who they were inviting to speak. That would have been disastrous. And that's something that sometimes groups today forget, that, you know, the ones who are outside screaming empower the ones who are inside negotiating, and vice versa. So it really is about a very multifaceted movement. Mm-hmm. In terms of the planning, my gosh, it just, you know, it's everything from In the case of ACT UP New York, you know, it was like renting buses to get down to Washington, D.C. It was figuring out what materials you were going to hand out. What did you want them to say? How many copies were you going to make? Could you pay for them? Or did you have people doing what we used to call guerrilla Xeroxing, you know, at their place of work after hours? Who was going to speak to the media? What were they going to say beforehand? Who was going to be available there? Who had the lists of the medications that people needed in case they were arrested and were going to need medications gotten to them in jail if they were kept in jail? Who were your emergency contacts if you ended up getting arrested and hadn't intended that? You know, legal observers, mapping out your particular route, safety marshals to try to basically get between the demonstrators and any possibly hostile observers or hostile police. You know, it until I was part of ACT UP, I had never taken part in a demonstration, and I had no idea how much went into a well-executed demonstration.
Well, we have to take a quick break, but we'll have a lot more with Tracy Hunt, reporter for WNYC's Radio Lab, and David Robinson, former ACT UP activist, right after this. This is 1A from WAMU and NPR. Hi, it's Jen. Just a quick reminder that you can make a donation to support this program, and it's very easy. Simply visit donate.npr.org/1A to make a gift to your local station. That's donate.npr.org/1A, and thank you so much for your support. This is 1A, and we're talking about the AIDS crisis, the coronavirus pandemic, and how to make protest meaningful. Well, Tracy, you talked to Dr. Anthony Fauci quite a bit for your piece, and he's a bit of a national hero to many Americans right now for his work on COVID-19. But at one point, ACT UP leader Larry Kramer called Fauci a murderer in an open letter, and Tracy, you actually read part of that letter to Fauci. Let's listen.
Can I read you a little of Larry Kramer's open letter to you? Because it's so mean, so I feel like I have to ask permission first.
No, of course. Okay. I mean, that was the famous San Francisco Examiner open letter to an incompetent idiot, right? Right. Murderer. Right.
Yeah, it's like, Anthony Fauci, you are a murderer. Your refusal to hear the screams of AIDS activists early in the crisis resulted in the deaths of thousands of queers, with 270,000 dead from AIDS and millions more infected with HIV. You should not be honored at a dinner. You should be put before a firing squad.
Right.
And yet when you asked how he responded, he wasn't angry.
If somebody is that angry to be able to print that in a national newspaper, I mean, I got to find out what is it that has stimulated him to do that.
Talk a bit about what Dr. Fauci was doing at the time and his relationship with these activists.
Yeah, I think that was probably one of the more surprising things to me, because as you said, he is seen as a national hero to so many of us at this moment. But at the time, he just was not beloved among a lot of activists. And, you know, when it's sort of funny because, like, when you hear him, you know, have that very compassionate response of saying, oh, I got to call this guy. I need to find out what's going on. Like, why is he so angry? The cynical part of my brain is like, okay, all right, Dr. Fauci, you're like going to do this because it makes you look good and whatever. But even if he was just doing that to make himself look good, I think that is a pretty remarkable example of leadership. Because can you imagine that happening today? I don't know if I could. I feel like, Larry Kramer, there would be a lot of takes on Twitter about how he was, how he shouldn't be doing this and how Dr. Fauci's on your side. And, I feel like there would be no moment for an actual conversation. Mm-hmm. And so he did take this, he was the head of NIAID, which was a part of the NIH, and he was running all the AIDS research. And ACT-UP activists had a lot of demands. They wanted things like compassionate use, fast tracking drugs to get to people that can help them. They wanted things like executive committees at NIAID, at the NIH, and they wanted to have a member of those panels to be somebody who was actually living with AIDS. They wanted things like they wanted them to start testing more drugs, because at the time AZT was the only available drug and it was being tested over and over again, and they felt that that didn't make a lot of sense. They also wanted drug trials to be diversified.
Did Dr. Fauci's interaction with the activist shift how he was responding?
Yes, he said that. I'm sorry, I went on a tangent. No, yes, he did say that he eventually came to see where they were coming from, and that he did believe that they were right. He hedges and says, they weren't completely right on the science part of it, but they were right in a lot of different ways. And he even at one time said, I think that if I would have been then, I would have been outside too, screaming. And so it did change, but, it didn't change fast enough for ACT UP. And that is when they did their Storm the NIH action, which is when they descended on the campus of NIH and held protests all day. And it was at that protest where an effigy of Dr. Fauci was burned. It seemingly worked, because a few months after that, there was more movement on some of the things that they wanted on their very long list.
Angela writes on Facebook, I visited part of the AIDS quilt when it came to the University of Tennessee. I felt so moved. What the AIDS quilt experience did for me was humanize the victims. They were college graduates, sports fans, parents, sons, and daughters. And Deuce emails, I want to thank ACT UP for the courage to be outrageous. Warren and David saved me and other gay men with the sacrifices of an entire generation. David, HIV/AIDS still exists, but in many places, thanks to innovations in treatment, it's become a chronic illness rather than a death sentence. How much of that success do you think can be attributed to these protests and the effort to get the government to pay attention?
I think a huge amount, because the combination of the people doing that demonstrating and the people inside who were serving on these review panels for various drugs who were, you know, really working in the most detailed, in-depth way with the scientists is what eventually led to the successful treatments that now exist. And if you even add something that still astounds me, you know, ACT UP, especially the women in ACT UP as leaders, launched a four-year campaign to get the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control, to expand the definition of AIDS to include the symptoms that women were getting. Because the original symptoms were based on what the original definition was based on symptoms men were getting. And it took 4 years of dogging the scientists and especially the administrators at the CDC to get them to actually make the definition scientifically correct, because they would dismiss it as, oh, that's just a social issue. But women were dying without even ever getting the assistance to you know, buy food, pay their rent. They were dying without a diagnosis. And that took 4 years. And that was only just one campaign. So I think it really had much more, not just ACT UP, the entire AIDS activist movement had a really big effect.
Well, Cliff writes on Facebook, coming out was a really big deal at the time. It took a mountain of courage to put yourself out there. I believe it's the reason why the gay community advanced as fast as it did, knowing for yourself that the people who came out were not the evil monsters presented by the clergy. They were your family members, your friends, your coworkers, people you cared about. You know, David, when you think about the gay rights movement, on one hand, it's been incredibly successful, but you could argue that a lot of that success came through friendly assimilation, the idea that we're just like you. And this is still a tension in the movement, that the goal shouldn't always be to be accepted into the mainstream. It's a pretty thorny issue, but where are you with that today?
Yeah, I actually do feel that a lot of the progress... I'll just say it, like gay marriage, that's wonderful, but not if it comes at the expense of admitting that gay people have sex. So if you have to win those, you know, the battles in the campaigns to get certain rights, but you have to edit out most of who you are, that's unacceptable. Because then it leads out the folks who can't assimilate or who truly do not want to, because it's a betrayal of who they are. So my vision of progress is one that really includes those who are comfortable assimilating and those who aren't. And we're very much at that kind of movement now. You know, the focus on trans rights and violence against trans people is very much an expression of the way in which the mainstream gay movement try to leave out anyone who would make the mainstream uncomfortable.
That's David Robinson. He's a former member of ACT UP, the AIDS Coalition to Unleash Power. Also with us, Tracy Hunt, a reporter with WNYC's Radio Lab. She's producing a Radio Lab episode focusing on the issues we've been talking about, and it's set to drop later this week. Make sure to tune in. Thanks to you both so much for joining us today. This conversation was produced by Paige Osborne, and our podcast is produced by Matthew Simonson. To learn more about them and the rest of the team, visit the1a.org. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Jen White. Thanks so much for listening, and let's talk again tomorrow. This is 1A,